Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the congressional inquiry heats up into whether President Trump solicited the Ukrainian government to interfere in the 2020 election, a key point in the inquiry will be the testimony of two whistleblowers who were alleged to be in the American intelligence community with knowledge of what was said in the conversation to the Ukrainian president. Their testimony will be key in the House's decision on whether to impeach the president. And while the stakes are incredibly high for these whistleblowers, America has a long history of whistleblowing, even predating the United States. My guest today says whistleblowing is an important but unrecognized cousin of civil disobedience in holding political elites to account and is rooted in the country's DNA. Allison Stanger documents the history of whistleblowing in America from its very first episode, which exposed a corrupt Revolutionary War Commodore, Esek Hopkins, and resulted in the first whistleblowing protection law, which was passed by the Continental Congress, all the way through history, through Edward Snowden's WikiLeaks disclosures and the first years of the Trump administration, in her book Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. It's published by Yale University Press. Allison Stanger is a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College. She's a New America Cybersecurity Fellow. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is the author of the previous book, One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. She's contributed to Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, The Financial Times, New York Times, and U.S. News and World Report. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Stanger, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Rich.
Your book comes at a most interesting time, as now we've seen two whistleblowers have emerged from the intelligence community, and there's also another that seems to be going through the process in the Treasury Department. Now, your book's publication predates these latest revelations, but what was it that focused your interest in the history of whistleblowers?
Well, I wrote a book called One Nation Under Contract, which is a study of the privatization of American national security, the increased use of contractors in our foreign policy. And when I was done, I saw how the line between business and government had been really blurred, and we were trusting our elites to be honest. And I wasn't sure that was such a good idea, so I started thinking about how do we keep our elites honest in this world, and that led me to whistleblowers, because that's what they do.
Did you have any sense that whistleblowers were going to emerge like they have as you were writing the book? I mean, obviously, as you were writing the book, the revelations about the Russia investigation and the firing of FBI Director Comey emerged, and of course the Mueller report and the like. But was there any sense that whistleblowers like we're seeing now were going to emerge?
Well, I thought that they probably would because of the unprecedented situation we were in, because whistleblowers have been important throughout American history. We passed the world's first whistleblower protection law in 1778. And so it's really been something that's not a partisan issue. That's why both Democrats and Republicans unanimously endorsed turning the complaint over to Congress. It really is in America's DNA. And so that's why the issue is so important today as we're trying to sort fact from fiction.
1778, this would have been the Continental Congress. This was before we're even a republic. So this history of whistleblowing goes way back. And I gather from the book that our founding fathers really did see it as a useful tool against corruption. And they took stances to protect them through early laws. Tell us about the oldest story of a whistleblower.
Well, the oldest story has to do with the first Commodore of the U.S. Navy, a man by the name of Esek Hopkins, who is responsible for that first law. He was essentially defying General Washington, who was telling him to engage the British at various places for the Revolutionary War, and he would instead take the U.S. Navy places that served his commercial interests. So it really, the first law really comes from an instance of a public official abusing his public office for private gain, looking out for himself rather than for the United States of America.
Now that sounds pretty crazy. You're in a revolution, you hold your office from the fact that you're fighting for your independence, and yet you refuse to obey orders from the commander-in-chief. Why wasn't he just removed?
He was loyal to Rhode Island elites more than to the new country. He also tortured British prisoners of war, which the founders thought was unacceptable, which I find very interesting because it was during wartime. Usually we look the other way when there are abuses during wartime because we're fighting for our survival. But even in wartime, the founders thought and Congress thought whistleblowing was important to keep leaders true to the principles on which the new nation was founded.
Now, the question of Commodore Hopkins, was it a matter of the fact that he was torturing and abusing prisoners that led him to be removed, or was it the privateering, you know, using the office for his own personal gain that got him sacked?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rich, because for my book, you know, the standard story was that he was removed for torturing British prisoners of war. But I dug really deeper using digital archives and searching on keywords and found this other story about his defiance of George Washington. So that's something new that's in the book that I think is really interesting. I also hope the book can provide a context to readers because it takes you on an episodic history of whistleblowing in America from the founding to the present that gives you a context for interpreting what's going on right now, hopefully in a kind of clear-eyed, nonpartisan way.
When the Continental Congress put in the first whistleblower law, what were the protections? What protections did they provide for somebody who blows the whistle on what they see as wrongdoing?
Well, what happened was that there were 10 sailors who filed the complaint on his ship, the Warren, and two had the misfortune of residing in Rhode Island. So those two, because he was powerful in Rhode Island, were put in jail. And Congress paid their bail to get them out of jail. They paid their legal fees. They legislated against retaliation against whistleblowers, and they also demanded that all documents surrounding the case be made available to the public, which is why we know about the story today.
That is interesting, and coming at a time during wartime. But of course, you know, this was exactly what the founding fathers were railing against, the fact that all this, you know, the way the British administered the American colonies was done in secret without any participation.
Exactly right. And they really thought, it's interesting, they thought that Britain was corrupt and, you know, was not living up to its own ideals in the way it treated the colony. So we broke with Britain, in a sense, so we could form a new republic and do it the right way. So that kind of anti-corruption idea is at the soul of the American project. We don't want our public officials to be acting for their own personal interests. We want them to be acting on behalf of the American people.
Now, in the course of your book, Whistleblowers, you tell a number of incidents of very high-profile whistleblowers. I was interested in how you approach the idea of the whistleblower, the decision to go public, to, you know, break the bonds of their government employment or the position they hold and the trust that they hold to make something public. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And, you know, you put your finger on something that's so important in national security whistleblowing, is that anybody who's a national security employee is, in a sense, breaking the law by leaking information because they're supposed to protect classified information. But sometimes there's higher principles at stake where you have to break the law in order to uphold the system itself, the rule of law. And that's what I think you see happening today with these whistleblowers. Now, it's a tough road to hoe because while we celebrate whistleblowers in theory in the United States, in practice, when media attention turns away, the standard pattern again and again is they lose everything. They have to sacrifice their careers, their friends and family are retaliated against. They sacrifice enormously for certain ideals. And so I think we have to be very grateful to people who are willing to come forward and speak truth to power under those circumstances. They're doing it for all of us, not for themselves.
I was struck by the account of the army officer that exposed the abuses at Abu Ghraib. And, you know, yeah, when he came out with this idea that, you know, shared the photographs that were readily available among the army officers there, he said, you know, I just want to go home. I just want to get away from this and go home. And the first thing somebody said to him is, you can't go home.
Yes.
It's not an easy decision for a whistleblower to take that, because our track record in actually protecting them is not real good.
No, and you know, it's what they're sort of doing is they're sort of looking at the status quo, and everybody's saying, oh, this is acceptable, this is fine, and they're saying, no, it's not fine, this isn't fine. You know, here are the reasons why it's not fine, and nobody wants to hear that because, you know, we have our illusions about reality that make us feel comfortable, but sometimes you need to wake up and smell the coffee, or else you're going to lose everything you value. So that's what they help us do. They help us to kind of see our own blind spots, if you will.
the assertion that's being made today and was certainly made in the case of Abu Ghraib and a lot of different cases is the assertion that the whistleblower is a traitor. That is not new, is it? That goes about as far back as whistleblowing in the United States goes.
Yeah, and it's especially true in the intelligence community or the national security realm because they're never supposed to leak classified information. So that is a common charge, which has a little element of truth in it. But again, if you look at Joseph Darby and Abu Ghraib, I mean, you probably want to know when there are these abuses of power on the part of our military. And incidentally, in that incident, there were a lot of contractors involved. So that's this additional wrinkle when you kind of mix up public service and business, you can get some unsavory outcomes.
Of course, this goes back to your previous book, but that whole idea of contractors performing essential work for the government becomes more problematic when you're talking about possible wrongdoing or corruption, because as a part of outsourcing, the government gives a lot of immunities to those contractors.
Yes, and you know, you see this unfortunate thing with the U.S. military where uniformed personnel are doing the exact same thing as a contractor, but the contractor is making 3 to 4 times as much. Yet the members of our military are public servants. They're serving their country. They believe in the value of disinterested service. And obviously a contractor is serving a company that's not committed to disinterested service. It's committed to profit. And those are two very different values. So that is kind of at the heart of what we're seeing right now is do we value people who are serving their country, or do we say that anything goes and however you can make money is just fine?
And there's no sort of code of uniform justice that applies to contractors.
Yeah, they're in a kind of gray area. They're able to escape and elude prosecution in a way that members of the military aren't. So they introduce this real challenge to us as a republic and a democracy, as how we keep these values alive in a world that's increasingly just motives, values making money.
My guest today is Alison Stenger. She's a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College and a New America Cybersecurity Fellow. Her new book is titled Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. It's published by Yale University Press. Of course, it went to press well before the current whistleblowers that we're talking about today came to light. I was, though, struck by the similarities of today's whistleblowers in the case of Daniel Ellsberg and his leaking of the Pentagon Papers, which you write about in the book. You know, these were highly classified papers that were classified not because they were necessarily super secret, but because their exposure would be embarrassing and expose the lies of the government. So why is this sort of whistleblowing case so important?
Well, I think, you know, what that tells you, and it's true today too as well, that there's a real interest in classifying everything because it does protect you from being exposed. It's better to keep secrets because information is power. But obviously we don't want our leaders lying to the American people. And that's what Ellsberg exposed, that there was systematic lying about how the Vietnam War was going to the American people who are making decisions about the war effort. So we don't want leaders who lie to the American public. We obviously can't have a democracy if we can't distinguish between truth and fiction. So my book, I'm really trying to look at both sides of every argument. And I'm a tenured professor. You know, no one can fire me for anything I say, so I believe it's my job to tell the truth. And that's what I try to do in the book and let readers judge for themselves on each case.
Of course, Ellsberg was accused of treason. He was actually working for the RAND Corporation, again, a private contractor working for the national security apparatus when he leaked those documents. And yet he was also called a traitor, and there was, you know, everything they could do to prosecute him. They tried. Yet he took great care in the release of the Pentagon Papers to make sure that nothing was released that could actually harm national security. How often is that the case with intelligence whistleblowers?
Yeah, you're right. Ellsberg was really releasing early history, so there was no threat to current operations. And he went around, and he was an insider who tried to complain from within. He tried to get someone to take up his cause within Congress. And the reason he went to the New York Times is no one was interested in doing that. Of course, what happened once the New York Times published the first story on the Pentagon Papers, they never named Ellsberg as the source. He remained anonymous. But Washington insiders immediately knew who it was once that story broke. So he was quickly in danger and charged under the Espionage Act and thrown in jail. And he's probably lucky that the Republicans made the foolish mistake of breaking into his psychiatrist's office, which wound up getting him
acquitted. They threw the case out, basically.
Yeah. And I don't think they would have if that hadn't happened.
You mentioned the Espionage Act, and that's been a frequent tool against whistleblowers. How often is it used?
Oh, it's used. The Obama administration, Snowden was the seventh person that the Obama administration charged under the Espionage Act. So it's become increasingly relevant in the Internet age. And in whistleblowers, I really give you a history from the founding to the present, but I divide it into two parts, before the Internet and after the Internet, just because I think that changes everything. It speeds up the news cycle. We now have a 24/7 news cycle, which allows, you know, mistruths to kind of propagate across the Internet in unfortunate ways. And it also changed the terms of what the intelligence communities were doing, because all those communications were now potential information that could be reviewed as long as it wasn't an American citizen. So that's what makes the Snowden case so interesting, because it involves that change in information flows.
And despite you being an American citizen, that didn't necessarily prevent you from being surveilled as well at times.
Yeah. But what you see with the Snowden case is really, and this is something, you know, I want your listeners to understand, is when I researched whistleblowers, I interviewed all the NSA whistleblowers, including Edward Snowden, but I also interviewed senior leadership of the NSA, and that was a hard thing to do. But what that really brought home to me was how the intelligence community sometimes is completely misunderstood from outside, because they can't defend themselves against charges. They're really committed to keeping everything they do secret, because from their perspective, you know, one little piece of information they might release could be the enemy's missing jigsaw puzzle piece in a larger scheme to subvert the security of the United States. So they can't really defend themselves. But what Snowden really revealed, I think, is important, because he showed that the NSA had adopted emergency measures after 9/11, which were justified. We had just been attacked on our soil. They did it to keep us safe. But then those emergency measures, over time, became business as usual, with no public discussion of it. And that's what Snowden's leaks forced us to have, a public conversation, and it led to changes in the Patriot Act. So in some sense, I say that he may one day be our first traitor patriot.
And as you well know, Snowden remains a very controversial figure to this day. What was the reaction from the intelligence officials? You know, there's a debate over how much of his leaks hurt national security, beyond embarrassing national security, but actually hurting national security. What was your sense? What was your takeaway from hearing both sides?
I explored this extensively in my book, and what I came away concluding is that warrantless surveillance of any kind is probably not in the interest of American democracy, because there is very little evidence to show that it helps keep Americans safe, but it obviously undermines certain constitutional rights. So that's not a good idea, and that should be brought to a stop.
I want to talk about you mentioned earlier the rise of Internet and the Internet surveillance, and this is one of the reasons why the intelligence community has emerged as an important source of whistleblowers. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of the intelligence community in whistleblowing today?
Well, it's funny that you should ask that question, because that's the wild thing we're seeing. And, you know, intelligence community whistleblowers are rare creatures. This is the last thing that a member of the intelligence community wants to do. If you have a family or friend who's in the intelligence community, you know that they don't want to even talk about what they do. They can't. They're not supposed to. That's a whole secret life they have. So the idea of you know, complaining about internal conditions is something they do not do lightly, because of the kind of community and culture they're part of. So that's why I really think that this whistleblower complaint is something of a miracle that it reached the American people, because there are all kinds of hurdles that have to be overcome to get that information in Congress's hands.
Of course, we know this. Now it's October, and this is coming to light. You know, the first approach to the Inspector General happened in early August. So this has been kicking around the government officially for several months.
Yes, and I think we're going to see more whistleblowers coming forward now, because that tends to be a pattern, too. When one person speaks out in a situation where things are unacceptable, others start speaking out, especially when there's kind of a real gross violation of the norms of service that all these people are accustomed to.
My guest today is Allison Stanger. She is a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College. She is the author of Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump, published by Yale University Press, in which she chronicles the history of whistleblowing in American government, which goes all the way back to the colonial era, through the Gilded Age, and into the 20th century, and now the 21st century. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One of the things that how government reacts to the disclosure of embarrassing information is the use of classification. You know, you hear people from both the right and left say that, you know, the government overuses classification to prevent politically damaging information getting out, as well as security damaging information. What are the possible changes to the classification system to prevent the disclosure of politically damaging information?
Yeah, it's a tough question, because the natural tendency is to overclassify everything. It's the safest road to go. But it's clear that there's a lot of overclassification. I mean, some of the WikiLeaks documents were classified information that was readily available in newspapers around the world. So it is a system of extremes. But there's things you can do to mitigate that, and that's why the whole whistleblower system within the intelligence community is so important, because it's a check and balance on that tendency to overclassify. There are some things we do need to know, because the American people have to have a public discussion about them to decide where we go from here.
What about the protections for whistleblowers? Are they adequate today?
It's interesting. You know, as I said before, whistleblowing is really an American tradition, and in the corporate sector you see all kinds of well-developed systems. But in the national security realm, it's kind of a shaky business, because the main statute, the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2012, explicitly excludes national security employees from protection. So then there are a couple of other laws that attempt to set up some way for whistleblower complaints in the intelligence community to be shared with Congress. And that's how you saw this complaint come forward. But again, there isn't really clear protection from retaliation if they're excluded from this main law on the books that applies to all government employees. So it's risky business to come forward with this sort of complaint. It sort of emphasizes the seriousness of the situation in which we presently find ourselves as a nation.
Now, your book not only spends a lot of time on the current administration towards the end of the book, but at that time it was the Mueller investigation and the firing of FBI Director Comey that you spent a lot of time on. But there's also a whole other section of the book which looks at the corruption that exists between government and business. And it's interesting that you spend quite a bit of time looking at corruption in the Gilded Age, and you contrast that to today. And I think your conclusion is, well, this sort of thing, which was hidden in the 1880s and 1890s, is wide open now. It's very much open. And Supreme Court decisions now have basically said corruption can't happen unless you see a clear quid pro quo, in which you sort of state, I'm doing this in exchange for that. This makes public corruption a lot more difficult to whistleblow anymore, doesn't it?
Yes. No, we live in a very corrupt age. And, you know, the thing about what's striking to me is in the first Gilded Age, when whistleblowers exposed corruption, there was usually a sense of shame that followed. And the person was removed from office and the people were outraged. Today, corruption is exposed and nobody's outraged anymore, and it just continues on. And it's extraordinarily damaging, because what's at stake here is the rule of law, but also our free enterprise system. You know, you can't have a free enterprise system in which American entrepreneurship can thrive and small businesses can flourish when crony capitalism prevails, because that's what corruption is. Corruption is elites exploiting the situation for their own personal gain, while ordinary people are sidelined and forgotten. And that is something we need to address in this country, and it's not a partisan issue.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the partisan lines that have been drawn in our country. You know, it seems difficult to put politics aside when it comes to potential wrongdoing in an administration and a president we support. you know, depending on whether we're left or right or Democrat, Republican, when it's our guy in, we don't see the corruption or the wrongdoing. What impact is that likely to have in our politics down the road?
Well, in my view, we're currently in a situation where if we can't come together as a people and demand that the system itself be respected, the rule of law system, then we'll no longer be a democracy and we're going to lose everything we value. I really think it's that serious a situation. But that's going to require people to think for themselves and to stand up for what's right as opposed to what their partisan position would tell them to do. So it would help a lot if we got some leadership on both sides to encourage people to do that and to stand up for the United States of America as opposed to their particular political tribe.
But you have to
admit, I'm hopeful that we can do that. I really am.
You have to admit, though, it is natural when it's your positions that are being favored by an administration to sort of gloss over that, to not look at it. Is it a matter of just taking a given situation and flipping the parties and saying, would you like it if your political opponents were in power and they were doing X, Y, or Z?
I think that's super important. If we could have more of that kind of reasoning and people realizing that what you do to someone else is going to come around and be done to you, and what kind of unintended consequences that has for American democracy, that would be an immensely valuable thing. But that's going to take the American people demanding that it be so. You know, the American people have to say, this is enough, and we need to get back to normal. And that applies to both sides. And if the people demand that, the politicians will respond.
My guest today is Alison Stanger, professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College, author of Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. Well, you've studied a lot of whistleblowers, Professor Stanger. What do you think the outcome is likely to be? I know we're right in the middle of this. We don't even know who these whistleblowers are. You know, I imagine there are a number of people desperately trying to find out who these people are. But, you know, you're hearing two whistleblowers in the intelligence community. There's another whistleblower that is moving through the system in the Treasury Department. What do you think the outcome from these whistleblowers will be?
Well, it's hard to speculate, and you can never really predict the future, but I'll tell you what my hope is. I'm hoping that the truth will come to light and that the American people will demand better from their politicians. And we can get things back to where they should be. It's almost as though you want to, you know, I'm a mom. It's almost like you're watching a toddler misbehave, and that toddler needs to be put in timeout. And there are a number of people who could be put in timeout. And we should all just take a deep breath and think about the things we're doing and how they're damaging to our country and our ideals. I think ordinary Americans understand what's right and wrong and understand what it means to stand up for their country, and I'm hoping we'll see them do that.
Professor Stanger, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich. It was a real pleasure.
Alison Stanger is a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College and the author of Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. It's published by Yale University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.